Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Amy Clark as a guest. Hello, Amy. Welcome.
Thank you very much, JP. Hi.
Thank you so much for being with us today and for your time. Amy is one of the founders and a partner at Tribe Impact Capital. Tribe Impact Capital is a B Corp certified wealth management company based in the City of London. We're actually just across from the Bank of England right now. But they're not just any traditional firm. They are redefining wealth. They are creating a new wealth order, as they say, where the investment opportunities are looked through three lenses: impact, personal values, and financial requirements. As part of this process, they have created their own methodology called Impact DNA, which they use to help clients understand their values aligned to the 17 Sustainable Development Goals in order to consider them when building their investor's profile. And Amy is responsible for working with clients and values and for leading their work on impact identification and evaluation.
That's true. That is very true.
Anything I missed on that introduction?
That was a very comprehensive and quite an impassioned introduction. I think you should be our marketing officer.
Very good. Happy to do so. So, as it is our tradition, we tend to start with our first question, which is, what is impact investing, Amy?
Impact investing is, or can be, many things to many people. For us at Tribe, our view of impact investing is the intentional investing in businesses that are creating, and I do stress this, net positive impact on social and environmental issues, the big social and environmental issues of the day, through their operations and, importantly, through their core product and service. So effectively, you're looking for really well-run businesses that are solving the problems of the day.
Very good. And then I saw that you mentioned kind of three areas as well in your website, which I highly recommend everyone to go to. And I may actually say this again along the podcast, but you mentioned something about kind of the responsible investment side, the impact investment side, and the social investment side as well.
There are a lot of different investment paradigms, different investment approaches in the marketplace, and some have been around for quite a long period of time. So when you look at ethical investing and faith-based investing, for example, which is what the churches and the faith-based investing community have been doing for hundreds, if not for thousands of years in some instances, that very much focuses on removing out of your investment approach the businesses that are creating products and services that you find unethical. So may not be adding huge amounts of value to society, but for you, these are moral conflicts with your personal code of conduct, you know, your belief system and your value system. So it's a more reductive approach to investment. You're taking things out. So it's not the proactive approach that, for example, impact investing takes, which is to identify what you care about and why you care about it. That's equally important. And then works to create a portfolio that has the opportunities, the investment opportunities in that, that reflects those. And within those, I suppose to a certain extent, those two bookends, you have a number of other approaches, for example, like ESG, so environmental and social governance, when you're looking at the operational excellence of a business, how it runs itself, for environmental issues, social issues management, and then governance as well. You pick up socially responsible investing as well, which is an evolution on from ethical investing, where you're starting to think about the businesses that are managing themselves for longer-term sustainability through to sustainable investing, which is, again, almost another distillation of that. It's a more focused approach where you really are then looking, starting to look at the well-run businesses that are beginning to move into that, not the mission-driven space so much, but the product and service arena where the product and the service itself is creating social or environmental value. And then the impact investing is where you pick up intentionality. So those businesses that are purposefully going out there looking to address these big issues of the day. So it's quite a huge spectrum, and it's a lot of different approaches. And at any one time in a portfolio, you might have any one or more of those approaches at play, depending on the client.
Perfect. And not to simplify, but maybe just to use a bit of examples, it would be from taking your investments away from, let's say, fossil fuels or oil. Or
controversial weapons.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then to purposely investing in companies that are actually doing renewable energy.
Yes.
And some of them indirectly are doing it or purposely have been created to do something of that kind.
Absolutely. Some of the companies that are quite interesting, I think, for this community of impact investors may have unintentionally stumbled across a solution to a key social or environmental issue. Others have intentionally set out to do just that. So, intentionality plays a part of the decision-making process in the impact investing space, but it is not the sole factor in looking at a business. You have to pick up other things, for example, like additionality, materiality, measurability. It's a whole range of wonderful jargon that we all tend to use, and we assume that everybody else understands it, which obviously a lot of the time with clients, they don't. But the approach, I think, that we have adopted and the philosophy that we have at Tribe very much is that impact investing is an approach to investing, not an asset class in itself. I think historically some people have felt that it's an asset class and therefore you can only find impact in private markets, private market opportunities. For us, you can find impact everywhere because all investing is impact investing. Every single time you invest in a business, you are creating negative and positive impacts. Even the most mission-driven companies will have negative impacts. It's the nature of the beast.
Kind, yes. Yeah. Yes. And then again, just I haven't done this before, I think. So, and again, I don't know the whole range of the setup of companies. Like, I was going to use as an example, Tesla, right? Which is a car company. It's an electric cars company, but then has a kind of a CO2 implication to then making available, the designs and everything. So that is kind of may have been set up purposely to actually reduce CO2, but may have not. Right? And like that, there are companies that, that one that just are doing exactly that.
You have to understand the net position of any company. So you are looking at a company through a 360-degree lens, effectively. And we tend to split it into sort of the three areas. One is the operations, two is the core product and service, and three is their marketplace activity in terms of their ability to influence behavior change, whether that's political behavior change, whether it's consumer behavior change. And when you have that 360-degree view of a business and you understand how to evaluate that, because sometimes it's not always possible to measure it, but you can evaluate it, and that might be a more qualitative evaluation. You're in a position then to be able to say, on balance or in balance, that company is net positive, at worst, net negative. What you are absolutely striving to avoid at all time are the net negatives.
Excellent. And I had not had this plan in my mind and in my notes, but now that you mentioned behavioral change, and I know that is something that is a theme or a subject that you care about as well from previous conversations, and this is interesting as well because I think about it as if people don't change and the way that they behave, what they consume, and I put actually that note as an action in my last article that I wrote. It's very different. It's very difficult because then companies, won't produce products for them, right? Or they won't change what they're doing because if you are misbehaving effectively, why would they change, because they have a business to run. But then you have, again, just to go back to the example of Tesla, somebody that creates a product that potentially people were not asking for, but then it's such a good product and it has so many good things about it that then people actually do change their behavior and they actually consume and make an impact.
I was going to say, I think the masters of doing this, not necessarily with impact products, but the masters of creating consumer change and behavior change at Apple, if you look at what they do, they don't sell product, they sell lifestyle. So they're constantly innovating and telling us and showing us what it is that we need to make our lives more fulfilling, their version of fulfilling, which is, you know, why it's generated this excitement historically around its brand. They're not waiting for the consumers to respond. They're creating the consumer reaction and response. Yeah. So it's the difference between sitting back and saying we will wait for the consumers to move and then we will respond, to those who lead and they lead by example and say we understand the issues that are in society at the moment. We understand the issues that our consumers are facing. We understand the issues that communities within which we live, work and play are facing as well. So we are going to take a leadership position now and create an approach to doing business and a product and service solution that actually addresses these. And it's a little bit, I suppose, in many ways, JP, it's a little bit like tribe. I am a great believer, and if you build the ark, people will come.
Yes.
And tribe in many ways, without wanting to sound too grandiose, but tribe in many ways was our articulation of the arc that was required in wealth management, the approach to wealth management that has been needed for arguably a long time. You know, the wealth management industry per se hasn't really innovated ever since it was born. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we were here 100 years ago having this podcast, the only thing that would be different about this really is the fact that I wouldn't be here because I'm a woman. So you know, there hasn't really been a huge amount that's changed. And when you look at the system as a whole, you look at finance as a whole, it's literally the sum total of the beliefs and the values of all of the individuals who are in the system. It's a very responsive entity, but it is literally the sum total of the thoughts and the actions of people. And because there hasn't been a huge diversity of thought in wealth management for such a long period of time, we've had in many ways quite a black and white, reflection of the system in wealth management, but also there hasn't been huge diversity in the system as a whole. So again, you have quite a black and white version of the system. That is changing now. You know, it's changing. There is more diversity of thought coming through, but also these things that, again, excuse the jargon, I will explain it, these things that have been referred to as externalities over the years, climate change, rising levels of poverty, waste, pollution, lack of education, lack of healthcare, these externalities have always been seen as something that sits outside of the decision-making within finance. These don't influence successful economic growth. And there is now, hallelujah, a realization, and the system has embraced the fact that these externalities are not externalities, they're internalities. They are the things upon which successful economies depend. They can radically erode the success of economies, both local and global, if we don't address them. So you've got the diversity of thought that's come into the system, plus this dawning realization of the role of externalities. And that was very, very, very much hammered home by the adoption in 2016 of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and previously in November 15, 2015, of the Paris Climate Accord. We now have a framework we can use. We have a system that is more accepting of change and in many ways is wanting change. So tribe was in many ways the recognition that there was an opportunity to disrupt. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day, actually. There's a difference between hijacking a system and hacking a system. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've been in finance. The finance system doesn't deal well with hacking. It doesn't like hacking. It tends to be very ill-tolerant and impatient of hackers, people who come in and try and radically disrupt the system. But it will tolerate hijacking. It will tolerate hijacking. So if you can get in and you can create a pathway within the system that is accepted, so it's disruptive, but it's not a full-sale hack, it gives you the license to then start to really affect positive change from within the system itself and to then started to think about what the hack might be when you're through the door. And Tribe was very much seen as a disruption to the wealth management industry, a disruption to the system, recognizing all of these incredible stimulus that we had, or the incredible stimulus that we had in the Paris Climate Accord that obviously was coming, because this is Tribe was in conversation in summer 2015, mm-hmm. When I met David Scott, who's our chairman, through to the SDGs we knew that was coming as well. But also this recognition that wealth holders were becoming more and more frustrated without having somewhere they could go and have these conversations without being told, the universal myth, you'll sacrifice financial performance. But also they didn't have anywhere they could go where they could have honest conversations and quite revealing conversations about their beliefs and their values, hence the behavior change piece.
Yes.
The system doesn't really deal well with emotion.
Yes.
It deals with hard facts, but it can't factor into decision making that well emotion. So how do you then quantify emotion into kind of hard parameters, hard facts that the system can then deal with? And that's actually a little bit easier than it might sound. And as you mentioned earlier, that's what we did with Impact DNA.
Excellent. I will cover that as well in one of the next points. So just kind of without trying to summarize everything, but we're talking about basically innovation, differentiation, customer experience, the situation, what was happening, the background of the sector itself. And all of that is kind of a bit of the why Tribe was founded, right? Mm-hmm. Just to deal with all of these, with the kind of hijacking type mm-hmm. model, mm-hmm. Which complies with all the regulations, working actually with, as I know, as people may read in some articles, working together with the FCA to try to make them understand and actually show the innovation, before it gets pre-approved, approved, etc. But you also have this very rich history. So you have outstanding founding members. You mentioned David Scott, who is managing partner of LGT Vestra, James Lawson, which mm-hmm. is another co-founder. And then I understand, as we know, so you have Harry Catchpole joining you, Lizzie Scott, and now you have a growing team. Mm-hmm. I just saw actually yesterday you have a new partner as well. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So you have, for those that do not know, so Tribe actually is, is the innovation on a very rich history of wealth managers and innovators in the industry. Mm-hmm.
It's a collision of seasoned wealth management experts. I was a little bit wary about using the word expert because I don't think anyone really is, because we constantly learn throughout our life.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
But wealth management specialists with a deep history in the marketplace, and impact specialists, again, with deep history in the marketplace as well. And it's the collision of those two worlds. And that needed to happen because I think for quite a long period of time, when you look out into finance more generally, you've had the finance industry sort of on one hand, and you've had the sustainability / kind of impact industry on the other hand, and it's in many instances been quite a competitive relationship, and it's driven us so far. So we have had the rise of ESG investing over the last 20 years. It's been quite a stellar growth. We've had the rise of sustainable investing. We've got the rise of impact investing. So it has driven some growth, but has it driven enough growth? And actually, if we bring these communities together more to work more cohesively in partnership, under the auspices of a mission-driven wealth management that is in the business of helping people reflect themselves better into their wealth and create the change that they want to see, if we can prove that this model works, will others follow? Mm-hmm. Will it become part and parcel of an approach to wealth management that is more acceptable? Yeah. Not just in London, but just more globally. And there are others out there doing very similar things to us, who were here before us, Sonen Capital in the US, and the work that Raoul and the team over there have been doing. So it's that collision, really, of those two worlds. So our clients at any one time get access to really good financial advice, but also the ability to understand what is impactful and what's not impactful. But I think even more importantly than that, more philosophically than that, being able to understand who they are and feel comfort in the conversations they're having, because we are all very much in tune with our own passions and beliefs and values and the change that we want to see. So there's a comfort, there's a camaraderie there. You know, I see your impact DNA, so I feel comfortable showing you my impact DNA. And you've been through it, so you know what it's like. Yes. You know, JP, it's designed to be fun, but it teases out from you things that you might not necessarily have ever had time to think about or even thought about thinking about previously. And it does it right up front with us as well, so that it creates a relationship very quickly.
Think, you know, or thought or felt as well, because it's quite, it becomes at some points emotional when you start trying to understand what you really care about. So when touch a little bit on going back to the basics, right? So about wealth and the definition and what people, you know, see that wealth is. I picked up again from your website a couple of really nice phrases, you know, where you say, you know, that for many, wealth symbolizes status and materiality. You know, it says a definition of individual monetary worth. Mm-hmm. But for others, it can mean so much more. It says, but you here at Tribe, you believe that in the old English definition of wealth, which is the condition of well-being, whether personal, professional, environmental, social, or financial, but somewhere along, the way the original meaning of wealth has been, you know, forgotten, and that you are kind of bringing it back. You know? So tell us more about this and how has it been forgotten, and what is it that you think that you are bringing back?
I think the original definition, which very much centers around that sense of well-being, to get back to the hijacking analogy, has been hijacked. But it's been hijacked, I think, over many periods since the 13th century, which is when the original definition of wealth came to be. There's different phases in history where individuals have either been rewarded for accumulation, or they have come through periods of political stroke, social instability, where they have accumulated what they've been able to as a security measure. So you've had that kind of reward for accumulation versus that reaction to not having anything and therefore accumulating what you can. And there have been many instances in the time since the 13th century when that's happened. And and we wrote a paper which is on our website, which is around effectively where wealth has come from and where we feel it's going. And then you've had the intermediation of wealth as well. So you've had, dare I say it, the wealth management industry come to be, and that intermediation of wealth has very much been with a view to accumulation, you know, manage it, steward it, grow it. And over the period, I think, of time that the wealth management industry has been in play, again, we've had that sense of accumulation play in. Capitalism in and of itself should not be a bad thing. It should not be a bad thing. It should and it could be a force for real positive change and a force for good. But I think it plays to a human tendency to want to accumulate things, to want to have stuff. And we need to step away from stuff, material stuff, you know, whatever it is that we might have. And for us, when we think about wealth, my wealth is so much more than what I might have in my bank at any one time, or the house that I might have, or the car that I might drive, or the clothes that I might wear. My wealth is my physical wealth, my health. It's my happiness. It's my knowledge. It's that sense of spiritual enlightenment and being that I might have. You know, that to me, I have riches that other people may not have, that aren't the riches that people might immediately think of. So I have a huge amount of wealth in other areas of my life, and what we're trying to get people to embrace, and it's working, because I think people are ready for this narrative, is that there is so much more to wealth than money, so much more to wealth than money. But your money literally becomes a fuel. It becomes a mechanism for you to reflect who you are, to reflect the wealth that you have, those passions, those beliefs, those values. It becomes the fuel. It becomes effectively the tapestry onto which you weave your story. And that hasn't really been happening, partly because of the intermediation, but also partly because talking human tendency and human habit, everyone loves to talk about themselves. But when you actually listen to people talk about themselves, it's normally a marketing pitch as to what I've achieved, what I've got, rather than who I am. And people find it sometimes very difficult to talk about who they are. So this whole notion around interrogating what wealth is and what the purpose of wealth actually places some very, very deep-seated, narratives around beliefs and values. And how comfortable are you sharing those with a third party? And that's quite a big ask for a lot of people. You know, if I sit here and say to you, JP, right, what are your values? Now, you're gonna look at me and be slightly paralyzed for a moment and think, I don't quite know how to answer that. I know I have them, but if you ask me now to articulate them, I'm a little bit stumped.
Yes.
And also, I don't know why you're asking me. Are you going to judge my values? Are you going to judge me on my values? Yes. But I know you have them, and I'm pretty sure I know what they are as well, because we've spoken at length on a number of occasions.
Yes.
So if we can create a mechanism whereby we're able to help you articulate what your values are, because your values are literally just a reflection of the beliefs that you have. Not only do we help you understand what it is that you care about and why you care about it, we also help you identify any beliefs that you might have that are ultimately self-harming as well.
But it's interesting because it's all normally very transactional and kind of value-added, inverted commas, you know, in terms of what when people talk to each other and they introduce themselves, so hence, you know, the kind of successes and and accumulation, and showing what I have, what I have done, etc. Right, but also culturally, I'm thinking, let's say in this culture, which is the English culture where we are right now, it's not something that you do. You don't talk about maybe perhaps values and or emotions, right? So and because the first thing that comes to mind with my English hat on, is like why, what for, But I was going to ask you now. So from the people that are coming to you now as clients or prospective clients, what is the typical profile or what are you seeing that's changing in these, prospect investors?
So the one thing that is unifying across the clients that we have is the mindset. And Tribe was always, the reason we called it Tribe was because it was a collection of like-minded individuals. So if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary and you look at tribe, that's one of the articulations of what tribe actually means. So it's a collection of like-minded individuals, which for us is a mindset. So the unifying, I think, bond that all of our clients have is this mindset, this desire to want to reflect themselves or reflect self better in wealth, and to use their wealth to create the change that they want to see out in society. There are some groups of individuals who represent very heavily with us, women. So over 50% of our client base is female, which is part and parcel, I think, it's a reflection really of what is now happening with not just the intergenerational transfer of wealth, but the intergender transfer of wealth as well. So you look at disposable wealth in the UK and for example, in the US, and I think the statistics are something like by 2025, 60% of the disposable wealth will be in female hands. Now, that is game-changing socially, politically, economically. It is game-changing. So we know that women, you look at the research done in philanthropy, we know that women are far more predisposed to wanting to manage their money in a way that reflects their values. So we're not really surprised by that. We are thrilled, obviously, but we're not really surprised. We have a very young cohort as well. So I think it's half of our clients are under the age of 45. So again, we're attracting that intergenerational change that's happening. But again, within that community as well, we've got intergenerational transfer of wealth, and then we've got created wealth as well. We have, we have some tech entrepreneurs within that, and the beauty with tech entrepreneurs is that they're often, because of the nature of tech, hardwired into thinking, how can my tech change the world? So moving them into the how can my wealth change the world actually is it's not a huge process. That they're kind of already there in many ways. So I think the two segments that really do represent quite heavily are women and then the millennials.
Yes.
But then families as well. The family structures that is normally driven by the notion of succession planning, and then also safeguarding against some of the more toxic elements associated with wealth. We all know what they are and what they can be. So how do you use wealth as a mechanism through which you equip your children to be really successful in life? As well, and again, that's not just about what school they go to, that's actually about the life learning, the experiences, and getting the children comfortable with articulating who they really are. You know, not getting on the hamster wheel and feeling that I have to do X, Y, and Z because mm-hmm. that's what everyone mm-hmm. else is doing. Be mm-hmm. comfortable with who you are.
So is that the toxic side that you mentioned?
It can sometimes, be, because sometimes you, know, because you can have end, to like, yeah, you can end
feel
up...
feel the other people, your previous feeling, generation's
you're,
shoes.
You're looking for third-party endorsement sometimes all the time. You know, you're constantly referencing what other people are doing, and then you can use the wealth to shore up effectively what that is. But then we all know some of the other issues that can come with inheriting too much money too young without sort of a stable infrastructure yeah. around you okay. as well.
So it's basically what I hear is that you have the empirical evidence that, you know, all of this research that, you know, we read out there saying that, you know, 65% of millennials and women, you know, are willing to invest in impact or something that aligns with their value. I think it's over 50% already doing it. This is a Schroeder's report, I think, that I picked up somewhere. Then you have the fact that, funny enough, you know, there's some stats around this as well, that entrepreneurs normally tend to succeed after their 40s. Most people think that they, you know, well, all entrepreneurs must succeed when they're in their 20s. And you have most people that actually invest in, you know, either angel investing or doing something different are about 45, mm. you know, again, you know, rounding up numbers. So... yeah, so everything you're saying, you know, is very nice to hear.
Are you going to ask me how old I am now?
No. Because it just kind of ratifies, you know, that when you read about these stats and these surveys, etc., mm-hmm. it's not just that. It's not just people talking and replying, you know, positively to the surveys, but it's actually what's happening at least here in Tribe and Capital. Mm-hmm. So with all these, you know, what you actually are doing, you know, with these, you know, wonderful people with this different mindset, and you have Impact DNA, mm-hmm. right, which is your let's call it your baby. What you're trying to do here is to help clients create a legacy that reflects them as an individual, as I understand it. So you use the Sustainable Development Goals, the Global Goals, to guide your investments and allow your clients to identify what impact they wish to create in our world. And then to facilitate this, you have created these four tribe themes. Then, you know, once people go through the process, they can kind of understand, you know, kind of in a more altogether way, you know, where they more identify themselves, right? So can you tell us a bit more about you know, maybe the themes and the process that you go through with the clients? Yeah, the beginnings of Impact DNA as well. You know,
let me start with the themes, because, you know, the reason we put the four themes in place was not to interpret the goals, because the goals actually don't really require a huge amount of interpretation in terms of how you use them with clients. They do from an investment point of view. Mm-hmm. Some of them do require significant translation, others less so. But for any one client or any one consumer looking at 17 goals, it can be quite overwhelming. And a lot of those goals sit very neatly and very comfortably in families. So families of goals that work together to create a narrative. So we created these four macro narratives that are families of goals that enable our clients to see which way they naturally are predisposed. So tribe theme one is environment and ecology. And these are very much the goals that focus around planetary boundaries. Tribe theme two is education and equality, and this is very much that focus of social equity and social justice that sits within that as well. So it's that creation of inclusive economies or inclusive communities where no one is left behind. Tribe theme one is very much where nothing is left behind. So it's picking mm-hmm. up all of life on Earth. Tribe theme three is enterprise and infrastructure, and that's very much around the physical the physical environment that we need to create to deliver tribe theme one and respect the tenets of tribe theme one whilst also delivering tribe theme two. And then tribe theme four is really around the role of governance and partnership in driving tribe themes one, two, and three. So that's around the role of state, the role of business, the role of consumer, the role of partnership as well, and that sits within that. So at any one time, once we've been through the impact DNA process, and I'll whiz through that without making it too reductive in a moment, our clients can automatically see where they tilt, which areas they tilt towards. Now, you've been through it. You know which way you tilt. I know which way I tilt. You know, I am an environmentalist. I've always been one. I trained as one at university. So highly unsurprisingly, when you know, we've all impact DNA'd ourselves, I came through very, very heavily focused on tribe theme one. You know, it's my passion. It's kind of, you know, it's an articulation very much of who I am and what I believe in. But for me, all of the goals obviously are important because it's what my career's been in. The impact DNA process is effectively, it's the bringing together in many ways of three worlds. One, the very traditional and regulatory risk management processes that we all have to go through, and quite rightly. Two, the worlds of sustainability and impact, and how we as sustainability and impact professionals work with clients, whether they're private or whether they might have been institutional clients, you know, sustainability practitioners, how you work with clients to get them to affect change. What kind of questions, what kind of processes do you put in place to help people change the way that they view issues and also change behaviors? And then three, the world of one of our fellows, Greg Davies, who is a behavioral finance expert, and looking at the world of behavioral economics and infusing that in as well. So how do you use behavioral economics to make better decisions? And it's those three worlds really coming together. So it's a technology-enabled conversation that also uses gamification to help clients articulate their values. And within that, we use the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals as the what I always tend to refer to as the Impact North Star. This is the position on the horizon that we're aiming towards. But also within those goals is codified a global set of values, a sort of a uniform and globally accepted set of values, which we find incredibly helpful in helping clients articulate what their values are as well. Because we can, by helping them navigate the SDGs and the thematic passions within that, we can extract from that the values and play it back to the client in a way that makes them engage more with that narrative around values and go, yes, that is a value that I hold dear. Yes. And actually, now that you've said it, I understand it. But it effectively creates what I term, having gone through it, a stained glass window, client by client. And this window is effectively a representation of, again, your very traditional risk and return requirements, but also your values, your thematic passions and biases, how you think about impact as well. You know, are you a macro change maker or are you micro change maker? What type of impact are you looking for? Where are you looking for that impact? It takes all of those impact characteristics and positions it in the stained glass window. So you will have this beautiful window, which is very unique to you. That's colors and patterns and tones that we distill through that impact DNA process. And we're then able to hold that up in front of the global investment universe across all asset classes and look for those colors, those patterns and those tones to be reflected back so that we can then cherry pick the best opportunities that meet those financial requirements, that align with your values, and that deliver that impact that you're seeking. That's impact DNA.
Perfect. And maybe to add as a reference, you know, because I've been through the exercise with you, you know, for other people that are think of coming and talking to you and maybe talking to Tribe and going through the impact DNA kind of exercise. I'm not sure if you actually share with everyone before, but the way it works is that you actually look at all the goals. In practical terms, you look at all the goals one by one, and lovely Amy here asks you questions about you know, where are you, how would you actually split them in different columns. And in that way, what I can share with you is that as you do it, you start realizing that there's always like everything, right? It's something that's what you think you like than you are, versus once you actually get asked the right questions, you realize you know, that your focus and your priorities are not potentially what you thought that and they were, and more specifically in this case aligned with something very particular, which is the global goals. So when I did the exercise, what I can share with people in terms of my experience and this, you know, I think going back to the point about client experience, and I think that this is something that really differentiates what you guys are doing, is that it made me realize and helped me understand that, you know, what I really, really care about. And if I had to put, you know, my money where, you know, my values are, you know, it helped me really understand that. But, and again, I highly recommend it to anyone and everyone that would like to, do that, invest in impact, to come and talk to you about it. And then you mentioned about the scholars, right? And then I think what people may see on the website is that you have this, it's like a front end, like a dashboard where people actually can see, which is in a bit of a, what builds up from, you know, this part of the exercise. And then lastly, so this is a, like a building block, right? So it's very important. I think you mentioned it in a certain way, is that this doesn't replace all the other risk assessments and all the other things that, you know, a wealth manager would do. It's just an add-on, a kind of extra that you do, so that it helps people really understand, you know, where their money is being invested.
It's what we lead with. So it's part of the reason why the FCA brought us into the Innovation Hub, because we recognised very early on that part of the problem associated with the wealth, the approach to wealth management, and this frustration that a lot of private clients felt, and also institutional clients felt, was that there wasn't a codified way in which wealth managers were able to ask these questions. And the default, therefore, was to go for the risk and return, kind of, you know, the slipping of the paper across the table, going, really sorry, but compliance needs me to ask you these questions. Can you fill them in? That is, at any one time, reducing you down literally to you, how you think about risk. And JP, you are so much more than how you think about risk. You're not a singular human being. You're not a binary human being. You're a complex individual with lots of passions and thematics and morals and ethics and thought processes at play. And we needed to find a way to do that. So we came up with this, took it to the FCA. And the FCA, obviously, as you can well imagine, were very, very interested in saying, well, this goes way beyond what the industry is doing. And actually, we can see that this is going to add real value to the client relationship, because what it does is it takes fiduciary responsibility to a certain degree, and it turbocharges it, because it says, if you also want to create systemic social change or systemic environmental change alongside your financial requirements, and you have clearly articulated that to your wealth management wealth manager, that becomes part and parcel of the fiduciary responsibility. And the FCA have been more active in that narrative, you know, over the last couple of years, as well as have other regulators.
And as you mentioned, as well as part of all of these, people have different kind of not only appreciation of risk, but they also how they go about, you know, investing, right? Through the exercise, I also remember that you may realize that is the micro-macro approach. There is the kind of hands-off, hands-on approach as well. There is a kind of direct impact versus indirect impact. And there may be cases that actually, you know, you don't want the wealth manager to manage your funds as much as you actually want to do it directly.
And you all know this, JP, as well, being very active in this space, is the impact trade-offs. And this is something that a lot of people don't talk enough about. Perfection doesn't exist in life. You know, nature doesn't do perfection. Nature does beautiful imperfection.
Some of my friends would really disagree with you.
I know a few people like that too. We won't name and shame them on this podcast.
No.
But people sometimes, I think, can allow themselves to believe that perfection exists in impact investing, and it doesn't, because humans aren't perfect. Therefore, anything that we build isn't perfect. You know, it's a reflection of our capabilities and who we are. So occasionally you will find that there may be significant impact trade-offs. So in the pursuit of creating one form of impact, you might have unintended consequences elsewhere. And for us, part of the narrative with clients is always, A, being able to explain to them, once they've been through the impact DNA process, where there may be potential trade-offs, and B, understanding where they would like to draw the line in the sand. Now, obviously, there are some absolute lines in the sand that we will not cross as a company, because we're a mission-driven company. We're a benefit corporation. We hold ourselves to very high levels of public accountability and accountability generally. But clients need to know that you know, there will be some negative consequences associated with any investment. And as long as you can play that back to the client to say, for the greater good, you are going to create this element here. We're comfortable with this element based on your articulated theory of change and the intended impact that that will create. Are you? That's quite a, sometimes quite a difficult conversation to have with clients, but it's a conversation absolutely that each and every one of us who's involved in impact investing needs to be able to have with their clients. Excellent. You cannot paint a picture of perfection for a client.
Excellent. Okay. And then following nicely from that, about identifying and measuring impact.
Mm-hmm.
So what factors do you look at, and how do you measure, you know, the impact that investments are having?
Yeah, so for us, unlike a fund manager, as you can imagine, it's quite difficult because at any one time you're looking at portfolios, bespoke portfolios that will have a range of different financial instruments at play. Some will be collectives, some will be single lines, and within that you've got multiple levels of reporting, both financial and then extra financial. There will be issues in consistency of reporting. There'll be issues in quality of reporting. There'll be issues in existence of reporting as well. So some companies might not report on things that you want them to, yes, and others will. So, you know, you have that issue with the landscape in terms of the data that's available. Then two of the big challenges are aggregation. So how do you kind of suck it all up to the top level and create a compelling narrative for a client? But then also, how do you attribute it as well? What literally and legitimately can you claim as part and parcel of the impact that you've created, given that you might be one of 1,001, 1,001,000, 1,000,000,001 shareholders? So those are ongoing conversations that are happening in the marketplace. And I know, obviously, you've spoken to Damien at EQ. And Damien has referenced this with you. The Impact Management Project is looking at how do you create kind of consistent reporting, mm-hmm, and reporting at portfolio level that is meaningful. And we've been involved in those conversations as well. We created our own framework, and we created our own framework recognizing those challenges that I've just articulated, that looks really at the likelihood of impact in the areas that you're looking for, the type of impact that you're looking for, and the areas of impact that you're looking for, that focuses very much on, in many ways, three levels of impact. One is the operational impact. So it's looking at and it's recognizing, and there are people in the system who don't believe that you can create impact operationally. We disagree. Of course, you can create impact operationally. You can create very bad impact operationally. On the flip side, you can create great product, great impact operationally as well if you manage yourselves well. So we look at operational impact as kind of an entry level, and looking at that and saying, okay, well, we don't want to discount operational impact, but we want to know how well the companies are run, and we want to be able to measure the net kind of contribution through the operations of that company. Then we wrap it up a little bit. So we say, okay, well, now we want to get even more refined. Now we want to look at how much of the core product and service is aligned to the SDGs and delivering the SDGs. So we start to look at sustainable revenue. And then level three, which is the really deep, focused, targeted impact, is what we term our additionality, materiality, and intentionality impact, which is when we're looking at those companies who operationally are really delivering net benefits in terms of how they manage themselves across any one or more issue at any one time. We're looking at the sustainable revenue, and we're looking at that to be set at quite a high threshold, very high threshold. So we're looking at the core product and service. We're looking at where it's sold, how it's sold, to whom it's sold. We're looking at pricing policies, etc. But over all of that, we're putting an additional layer of additionality, materiality, and intentionality scoring. So we're looking for companies that are creating and have created or are continuing to create or have the ability to and are now transitioning to create additional impact in the marketplace, i.e. if they didn't exist and or that product didn't exist, there would be a significant challenges in our ability to deliver any one of the goals that it might be aligned to or any one of the key metrics that sits behind the goals. Then we're looking at materiality in so much of how much of that business is really aligned to the key performance or the targets and the key performance measures that sit behind the goals. So how material is it in driving that change? Is it a significant, does it have a significant ability to create what it is that we want it to create? And then thirdly, we're looking at intentionality. which kind of does what it says on the tin. And that's a little bit harder to evidence, but we want to see the intentionality there. We are not getting at this stage too hung up on the measurability, because it's a big old rabbit hole. We do measure our impact, and our portfolios get level 1, 2, 3 reporting across all asset classes. And that's something that our clients really engage with. They like to see that. And we supplement that at any one time with targeted metrics on the areas of particular interest to them. But we tend to be a little cautious about just putting in carbon metrics, for example, because carbon metrics in isolation need explanation. People need to know that, you know, I have prevented, you know, X thousand or X million tons of CO2 going into the atmosphere. What does that mean? But also, if you have, for example, a portfolio that's very focused on the circular economy, a lot of circular economy businesses are actually quite energy intensive. So again, you're looking at that net position as a business. And just because they happen to be carbon intensive industries now does not necessarily mean that these are bad industries and that they are industries that effectively will be in structural decline. You have to look sometimes beyond the metrics to understand what's actually happening. And we want our clients to really engage with the change that they're creating. So we do have this quantitative reporting that will have metrics alongside it, but we also have the qualitative reporting alongside as well, really explaining why this company is in their portfolio. So, you know, we do use collectives, we use single line bonds and single line securities as well, because that's, in many ways, that's the way we're really able to, in many ways, turbocharge a portfolio thematically. Yes. For somebody.
And you do public and private as well.
Public and private, yeah. We've done deals. Yeah. We've done 3 deals for our clients, which have been really welcomed in terms of the impact areas that they're focusing on. So,
excellent. So now, sounds very much like a bespoke approach, right? Which is, you know, what the nature of the business is.
We're constantly looking at what needs to happen next. Yes.
Excellent. So now I'm going to think about the future, right? So what do you envisage will be happening with impact investing, and what do we need to do differently?
Well, I think impact investing, I mean, to a certain extent, if I was going to crystal ball gaze, I'd like us to get rid of the word impact. This is just investing. This is what investing should become. This is basically what good investing is. You're looking for businesses that are future fit businesses. And I say that quite deliberately, because the Future Fit benchmark, which is this new benchmark that the Future Fit Foundation have been working on and have deployed, is really looking at understanding which businesses out there are going to be fit for the future that we know is now coming. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful expression, because investing should be about the businesses that are going to be in growth. And if the businesses that are going to be in growth are the businesses, and we think the businesses that are going to be able to drive us towards this horizon that the SDGs and this picture of not perfection, but this picture of resilience and inclusivity that the SDGs paints, then we want to invest our capital there, because those will be the companies that should be successful, absolutely should be successful. So surely that's just good investing. And that's kind of where we'd like to see it go. You know, it's a human tendency to want to label everything.
Yes.
You know, you're a bloke, I'm a woman, rather than you're JP and I'm Amy. So, you know, it is a bit of human tendency, you know, to want to label everything. And we just like this to be known as investing. Where will it go? I think what the markets do in the next 12 months is going to be quite, or 12 to 24 months is going to be quite interesting. Somebody asked me actually earlier today, you know, if the markets, you know, we're headed towards the end of a market cycle, if there is some cooling down of the markets, is the impact investing industry mature enough and resilient enough to be able to withstand it?
Mm-hmm.
I think yes, because I think there is a growing appreciation to the fact that this is actually just good investing. I hope it does. I mean, let's face it, if it doesn't, then we're all slightly, you know, watted. Yes. But my gut is that this is, we're now entering a new, in many ways, a new decade, you know, come sort of 2020, but let's say 2019 onwards, where this is going to become the norm. And as a result, it will have hopefully an inbuilt level of tolerance, because this is the way that investment is seen.
Yes. Excellent. And then Then just before we were starting the recording, as you mentioned as well, about the speed and the urgency that we actually need to apply, right? And the fact that now we have the BBC, highly covering, what is happening and the challenges we have ahead. So that's what needs to change as well, just people getting involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, we could argue whether or not they're covering it well, JP, but that's a completely different podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or extensively enough, yes.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, there is. There's. I think we need vision, we need velocity, and we need courage. We need people to interrogate themselves, I think, quite honestly about their fears and the fears that might be holding them back from doing this, from accepting this as a paradigm, from getting involved in this, from recognizing the issues that we face. What is it that might be either driving you to negation, i.e. Denying that there's a problem, or to disavowal, denying that you're part of the problem? Mm-hmm. And that's, if you look at climate denialism, it tends to fall in those two brackets. But then you can look at more generally, I think, across the issues that are articulated in the Sustainable Development Goals. There's still a huge amount of that in the marketplace. And I think people need to sit back and say, what are my fears? What really are my fears? And am I going to allow my fear to dictate what it is that I do? Am I going to give it a vote? Or will I give it a voice and listen to the voice, but remove its ability to vote on what I do with my life? And I think that's really important, because at any one time, when I look out into the system, I see paralysis. Mm-hmm. And that paralysis comes from fear of change. And I spend a lot of my time, talking to people about fear and saying, well, what is it that's holding you back from doing the right thing? Because we all know what the right thing is. Yeah. Most of us do.
So the question there for the listeners is, are your fears holding you back and from taking action and getting involved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's particularly today as well, it's a special day. It's a Brexit plan voting on the...
Can't believe you dropped the B-bomb, JP.
So I think it has to be mentioned. So I wonder if the fear is going to have the vote of the MPs today. Sorry.
We will wait and see. I was going to say, that's almost like playing podcast bingo. Who can drop the B-bomb and who can drop the T-bomb? Yeah. You drop the B-bomb, I'll drop the Trump bomb. Who knows? I do feel at the moment that when you look out into society, you look kind of politically, we're in uncharted territory, not just the UK. I think, generally you look out, we're in uncharted territory. A lot of that is being driven by, I think, inequality and fear. I think, when you look out and if you think about us all, at any one time in our lives, we are all going to be paralyzed by a fear of something, whatever it is. And that's the belief system. Yeah. That's when you come back. And a lot of that will come back to, am I worthy? It comes back to a sense of worthiness and entitlement. Do I actually deserve to be here? Do I deserve to be living the life that I'm living? Blah, blah, blah. There's a deep psychology at play across everything that we do, whether it's political, investment, whatever. And I think the more that we can take the opportunity to sit back as individuals and say, what are my fears? What is it that's holding me back from either reaching my potential or us reaching our potential? The more that people are willing to have those honest conversations with themselves and their community, the people who help them, whether it's their wealth managers, their physical training coaches, whatever, the more progress we will make.
I agree. And as we come in to the last questions for today, we're going to talk a little bit about you, if that's okay. And I'm just going to, funny enough, and you mentioned about this before, I'm going to talk about all the successes of Amy. So Amy has had an extensive career with, over 20 years experience in sustainable business, social investment, impact evaluation, and social enterprise, having spent time that sometimes sounds like jail, but having contributed added value at companies such as EY, PwC, Microsoft, Bank of America, and the Charity Safe Foundation. And now she's now Impact Capital. I had a couple of questions actually to ask you, but the one question I thought I should ask you is so who are you, Amy?
Who am I? Who am I? Well, I'm old, according to you. I'm joking.
Did I say that? No.
No.
Maybe it's my... Sorry.
For anyone actually still listening to this podcast... JP and I know each other quite well.
Yes.
Who am I? I nearly always refer to myself, and I know a lot of people kind of groan when you say this, but I'm a global citizen. I'm a child of this global community that we all are. I am, in many ways, I am very much governed by my relationship with nature. I am an environmentalist. Whatever you may think of environmentalist, you can keep it, you know, to yourself. I don't really mm-hmm. care. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I was very much born one, and I had the most amazing parents who are still with us, who nurtured that. They recognized it very early on and nurtured that, which is fantastic. So I've spent my time on this planet right now has very much focused on the role of humans in working as part of nature and conserving nature, not owning it. We don't own anything, mm-hmm. But conserving and working with it as part of it. And as a result, I think I tend to be very much in tune with, we're talking actually about this, I think that we're talking about this over the Christmas period. We're doing a lot of work at the moment with faith-based investing movement, with Abrahamic and non-Abrahamic religions, which is fascinating, as you can well imagine, and that in itself is probably worthy of another podcast. I tend to find myself looking and learning from nature almost on a daily basis. So even when I think about Tribe and what we're doing at Tribe and the challenges of running a business, you know, setting a business up and running a business, I have found so much of my inspiration and so much of my answers from nature, and that's where I'm most comfortable. But other than that, I'm a nonconformist. I don't particularly like rules for rules' sake. I like to test the elasticity of rules. I'm very people-oriented and people-focused. I love to understand what makes people tick. You know, I'm not into transacting with you, JP. I want to build mm-hmm. a relationship. Mm-hmm. That sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But, you know, I want to build a relationship. Yeah, I want to understand who JP is and for you to understand who I am so that we can authentically interact. And that's when the magic happens. I am very passionate. I think the one word that people would probably use about me the most the most is colourful. It has been used on a few occasions. Same is a very colourful character. But that's because I'm very much in tune with what I care about and my passions. And I'm not governed by a need to seek third-party endorsement from anybody. I need people to understand who I am so that we can work together. And I think that's in many ways quite atypical of a lot of people who work in the sort of the impact industry. They're very passionate people who have these deep beliefs and these passions. And I think in many ways I'm probably... in some ways quite atypical of that community, you know, very much so. But I'm a very simple person. You know, it doesn't take much to please me, and it's the simple things that please me. I'm not into material kind of gains. I'm into experiences and, you know, relationships, fun, laughter, you know, the stuff that, you know, you take with you. So
very nice.
Hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah. And if I may add, mm-hmm. you know, Amy is very elegant, and and she makes you feel very comfortable all the time when you are with her. So and you, I'm sure that's coming across in the podcast. But also when you have the luck to meet her, the luck to meet her, you realize that it's a very pleasant person to meet and to talk to.
Thank you, JP. That's really sweet of you to say.
So one last one. So you mentioned your parents as, you know, kind of a backbone, even though you didn't use that word. But is anyone else that kind of inspires you or potentially a book or something that, you know, you can share with the listeners?
Yeah. I mean, there are so many people who, you know, whose books I've read, whose stories I followed, who inspire me. Ellen MacArthur. Mary Robinson, there are quite a few women,
okay.
which is probably not a massive surprise to you. Do you know, this is probably going to sound slightly wacky, which you won't be surprised with, JP, but I've had two rescue dogs.
Okay.
And my first rescue dog, Florence, who was famous, she was an absolute legend, she passed away in September 2017, and she was 17 and a half, X-ray Staffy. So on paper, a lot of people would just walk past her, you know, discount her. Mm-hmm. She has no value and, you know, she is not the kind of dog for us. Well, I had her for nearly 15 years and she was exceptional soul. And I learned from her every single day and she inspired me every single day because she had been thrown out. She had been beaten. She had been treated unbelievably badly by humanity, by humans. And she'd been discarded effectively as a worthless object. And her ability to trust, put her trust again into another human, and to be kind of who she ended up being was just exceptional, absolutely exceptional. And I think animals, especially dogs, often demonstrate more humanity than humans do. So I think, you know, if you spend time with animals and if you're able to create that kind of connection with animals, they teach you so much. And they will inspire you on a day-to-day basis just in terms of how they are and how they live.
Very nice. And her name was again? The name?
Florence.
Florence. Mm. So that goes to Florence then. Now to just one before the last one is about leadership. So, you know, you have had many, many roles in different companies. You know, you are a founding member here at Tribe. So what is a leader to you? How would you define it, or you know, what would you share, you know, with people that want to become, you know, leaders in the industry, or create another competitor for Tribe?
Yeah, which would be very, very welcome. The more bums on seats we have in this, you know, kind of party, the better. To be honest with you, given the state of things at the moment. Well, leadership for me is very much about hiring the best people that you can find and then getting out of their way. Mm-hmm. Letting them do what it is that they do. That can be quite difficult, I think, for entrepreneurs because we've all had our vision, we've had our idea, and it becomes a baby. You know, I'm not going to lie, Tribe is very much a baby. You know, I feel incredibly protective towards her, but at the same time, I know that you know you need all these other people around you to make it happen. And I think leadership very much is about finding the best talent that you can have, inspiring it, empowering it, and then getting out of its way to let it do what it can do. But I think within that, in terms of the inspiration, it's about being able to be visionary, create that sense of momentum, create that sense of change, get people bought into, you know, your vision. I think that's part of leadership, is being able, enable to do that, to enable them to then step up and say, right, okay, let me at it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Very much, it's never about telling people what to do. It never is about telling people what to do. But I think also it's about role modeling. It's being who it is that you say you are. There's an awful lack of inauthenticity, I think, in society. People say they're one thing, they turn up to work as one thing, and then when they go home, they're something completely different. And I've always rallied against that, which is why it comes back to people sort of saying, probably I'm quite colourful. What you get is what you see with me. I mean, obviously there are layers to every single person, but I live and breathe what it is that Tribe is trying to do. And I think that's really important. You can't go out and ask other people to reflect themselves in their wealth and reflect themselves better in their lifestyle decision, their lifestyle choices, if you're not doing it yourself.
Excellent.
So it's role modeling.
Yes, yes. And then as you're growing Tribe as well, I was wondering, are there any specifics around the people that you're looking for to join the Tribe? Anything that you want to share? What you like when you look for these people?
Passion. I mean, passion. You know, you've got to have passion. You've got to understand the nature of these issues that we're facing and the opportunities, therefore, that creates. And you've got to be passionate about that. And with that then comes the authenticity. You know, we're looking for people who are able to demonstrate that this isn't just necessarily something new that they've jumped on and said, oh, this looks really interesting, this is kind of what I want to get into. But they've been able to demonstrate some engagement with an area that they're very, very interested in or passionate about historically. To be honest with you, I think, you know, if you have bright individuals, you can pretty much teach them to do what it is that you need them to do. So you can teach skills. What you cannot teach is personality and authenticity and passion. You just can't do that. And I think you also really need to be willing to look for talent in extraordinary places. I'm a massive advocate of looking outside of the traditional employment system to find the talent, especially in this space, because we need that diversity of thought. So we do look for passion. We look for somebody's comfort and ability to very quickly articulate who they are, because we need that, definitely need that. And we are looking for diversity, and that's not just kind of the gender diversity or necessarily the ethnic diversity. We want that. We actually have a very gender diverse business. You know, we want to have a more ethnically diverse business for sure. So if anyone's listening and they're interested, please, you know, drop me a line. But we're also looking for that diversity of thought. So that's the socioeconomic diversity of thought as well. It's not just necessarily the privileged. It's looking, yes, for those who come from, you know, underprivileged backgrounds as well. We need that diversity of thought. So I probably out of the tribe of the one who tends to be, and I'm sure the guys wouldn't mind me saying this, the more left field out there. And you always need, I think, somebody like that, because you need to have that balance. That balance. But I think we would all be universally in agreement when we said passion.
Very nice. Very good. So there you go. If you are interested, this is what you have to consider. And if people want to get in contact with you, Amy, what is the best way?
Yeah, they can either come through the contact form on the site, mm-hmm, or they can drop me a line through LinkedIn. And do that. But yeah, if anyone's looking to work with a bunch of mavericks, drop us a line.
And so the last point is really just a call to action. What is your call to action for our listeners?
I think regardless of where you may feel you sit on the wealth spectrum, if you have a pound, if you have £1 million, if you have £1 billion, the one thing that I think we all need to get much more comfortable with and passionate about is the fact that ultimately we have control over where that capital is invested, in the food that it buys, the clothes that it buys, the houses that it buys, the energies that it buys, the cars that it drives. You know, wherever you are, it's a vote. It's a very powerful vote. And it is extraordinary the amount of people who, A, don't understand that, and B, have no idea where their money sleeps at night. So whether you haven't, you know, if you are lucky enough and economically fortunate enough to have, for example, a pension, or if you have some savings, or if you have an ISA, do you know where that money sleeps at night? Because it could very well be having a dirty little affair with tar sands or fossil fuels or controversial even weapons. It could be having an affair with the very things that you find abhorrent, the very things that actually do not reflect who you are. So do the research, ask the questions. Where is your money sleeping at night? Is it reflecting who you are? But then recognize that every single time you transact with capital, you are making a statement. So make it a good one.
Thank you so much for your time, Amy, again. Yes.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for this. This has been very enjoyable. And if anyone is still listening, I congratulate you.
I'm sure they will. So I just say bye for now, and until our next episode of Impact Leaders.
Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.